From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, what challenges lie ahead for the new head of the Education Achievement Authority?
Don't give us excuses about operations and computers. Do something. Make it happen. Otherwise, what was the point?
We look at fighting blight in Detroit.
Everyone seems to be paying attention, and we're going to be tackling this process or problem one community at a time.
And to look at the state's film industry.
We saw a big difference when we go out to L.A. now, whereas a couple years ago when I first started, it was still a lot of, wow, we don't know if you guys are really going to be around for the long haul. We're not hearing that anymore.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Of Detroit's buildings are blighted. That's upwards of 70,000 rundown, decaying properties. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we continue our week-long series looking at how Detroit's functioning under bankruptcy. This hour, the city's efforts to fight blight. Then it's the 20th season of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. We find out about this year's productions and how they're trying to attract larger audiences. But first, among the many questions that Michigan lawmakers considered as they hammered out the budget for the new fiscal year, how much should go towards Michigan's film incentive program? The state used to have one of the most generous film incentive programs in the nation, but that ended when Rick Snyder became governor and his promise he cut way back on the film incentives. For the 2015 budget proposal, Governor Snyder allocated $25 million, a fraction of the more than $52 billion that he planned for the entire state budget. Well, there was some give and take with the legislature. In the end, the film incentive program got $50 million for fiscal year 2015. That budget signed this morning by the governor. We're joined now by the director of the Michigan Film Office, Margaret O'Reilly. Welcome back to Stateside.
I'm happy to be back.
We last talked in February 2013 as the question of just how much would be set aside for film incentives was the big topic. And, you know, a year later, it was more of the same. How much and will it be ongoing or one time? Well, now that you got a budget and it's in there, what are your thoughts about that 2015 budget and what is there for film incentives?
Well, once again, for fiscal year 15, which starts October 1st, the Michigan Film Office will have $50 million available to help attract movies, TV shows, and digital media projects to the state of Michigan and support their investment here. And we're real pleased with that. Obviously, we feel that we can leverage that money along a broad spectrum of projects, a mix of projects, large ones, small ones, digital media, TV series, et cetera. So we're real pleased and think we'll have another banner year.
There's always this back and forth about whether funding for the film incentives will be ongoing. Is it one time? Would it help Michigan's film industry if this ended and this kind of fluidity was not there and you had an ongoing amount and you knew what you were going to have to work with and to offer producers?
Well, it's my understanding that the state constitution prohibits doing future funding allotments for programs. So we will go through this annual debate about how much to put aside for this program on an annual basis. And we've explained that to our partners in Hollywood. They seem to be comfortable now that we've had a third year in a row now with a $50 million fund. I think they're comfortable knowing that Michigan's got a very robust program and that it's cash incentive versus a tax credit. We continue to get a lot of kudos from the industry for having a cash incentive approach, and I think that that works for the governor as well and for the legislature because we know exactly how much money we're spending on this, and we can track it that way.
I am speaking with the director of the Michigan Film Office, Margaret O'Reilly, as we look at the film industry in Michigan and the $50 million for fiscal year 15 that has been approved. And as we talk, Margaret, Ben Affleck and Henry Cavill are all suited up as Batman and Superman because filming for the Warner film Batman v. Superman, Dawn of Justice, it's begun in Pontiac and around Detroit. Is this Michigan's biggest production to date?
As far as the amount of money they're spending in Michigan, yes, I believe it is Oz was very close. I don't know if I recall the Oz number right off the top of my head, but according to the application that was submitted by Warner Brothers for this production, their plan was to spend $131 million in Michigan for this production at multiple locations. So we were very pleased with that, and in exchange, you know, they were approved for an incentive to support that. And they are planning to have 6,000 hire mostly Michigan people, 425 full-time employees. So it's been a good production, and I think we're getting a good return on our investment for that project, definitely.
Yeah, I'm wondering, Margaret, do the big ones like Batman v Superman or Gran Torino or Real Steel or Oz, do they matter in a different way than the smaller productions, whether they're independent or studio?
Well, I have found that it's very important in this program to have a mix of projects. It's still very important to have your high-profile projects, your Supermans, your Transformers, which comes out later this week, that was filmed here in Detroit. It's important to have those large projects because it keeps the state of Michigan kind of on the radar screen. But we also feel very strongly that it's important to support our independent film industry and our Michigan film industry. So we really like to see a mix of projects between large projects, small projects, medium projects, digital media projects. That's the best way we leverage our program.
And when you get filmmakers, especially the ones that come from Hollywood and return to Michigan, and we have seen that happen, what do you hear from them that makes you, what is it to them distinguishes Michigan from other states that are competing for their business?
Well, I can tell you as a lifelong Michigander myself, born and raised here, I'm very proud of the fact that they often comment at the great workforce we have here, that they're very skilled, they're very dedicated, they're very dependable, and that they really see as something that's a huge asset to our program and to our state. That coupled with the fact that we've got such a wide variety of locations within a fairly short distance, you can get pretty much any kind of look you want within Michigan within just a short drive, anything from urban renewal to urban decay to small town America to country settings to lake living to beaches and ocean fronts to Bigfoot and just about anything in between. And that you can all do within just a short drive around the state. That's been a huge advantage. So between our infrastructure that we have available here with our studios and our post-production houses, our great talented workforce and dedicated workforce and skilled workforce, and our locations, that really makes for a great package, of course, with the incentive on top of it.
And I'm sure as the head of the Michigan Film Office, you are still weathering the critics of these film incentives who believe it's a poor use of government money and that they believe it hasn't drummed up the return to Michigan taxpayers that was promised. How do you respond to those critics?
Well, we recently looked at our program and how it returns the taxpayer dollars and its return on investment for the taxpayers. And we've seen an increase in that under the new cash program. So that's certainly a good news story. And we believe that it's stronger than many, many other states. And I also want to remind everyone, there's different ways to measure this program. There's one measurement of for every tax dollar that goes out versus the tax dollars that come in to replace that. There's tax dollars go out versus production dollars and investment that is spent in the state. There's for every job created, how many additional jobs are created. There's how much in business activity for every dollar, how much additional business activity. So many of those factors we are seeing positives on. And again, the ROI factor of, you know, dollars coming in versus dollars going out, none of these are able to put a value on the cool factor, as I call it. The fact that you've got Mark Wahlberg that's on Jimmy Fallon talking about what a wonderful time he had in Detroit, and everybody in America should go to Detroit, visit, bring their families, invest their money, forget about the bankruptcy. It's a cool, great place to be, and he loves bringing his family there. I don't know how you measure that. And so the fact that now we're able to say Superman was filmed in Michigan, it's the largest production in the country right now, That's fabulous.
You know, Margaret, one of the staunch champions, and I know I'm not overstating this, of the film industry in Michigan, is going to be termed out this year. Senator Randy Richardville will be leaving office. How do you think that might affect the future of the film incentive program? Because he certainly has been a stout ally.
Well, once again, I think that the administration continues, and the governor, we continue to look at the program and if it's going in the right direction as far as increasing value for the taxpayers. And because of that, I believe that there's still going to be a strong interest in keeping the program, that we'll continue to go through the annual debate at about what level. You know, even though there has been critics in the past about our program, and even in Hollywood, some critics of, wow, you had this great unlimited program, and now we don't know anymore, we've really seen that kind of subside. We saw a big difference when we go out to L.A. now, whereas a couple years ago when I first started, it was still a lot of, wow, we don't know if you guys are really going to be around for the long haul. We're not hearing that anymore. They're saying, hey, let us know when you get your new funding. We want to apply. We're from Detroit. Our parents are from Detroit. Detroit's such a cool place to be, for example, and other Michigan locations as well. So we're going to continue to try and advocate our obviously great assets of the state to the industry.
Margaret O'Reilly, Director of the Michigan Film Office. Good to talk with you, Margaret. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy. Take care.
You Game of Thrones fans are well-versed in the many families fighting for power in Westeros, the Lannisters, the Starks, the Baratheons, the Targaryens, and more. Well, get ready for a Westeros resident with a Michigan connection. Game of Thrones writer George R.R. Martin was fundraising for a wildlife sanctuary in a food depot in his home state of New Mexico. For a $20,000 donation, Martin said he would use the donor's name in a future novel. In the words of the crowdfunding site, you can choose your character's station in this world, lordling, knight, peasant, whore, lady, meister, septon, anything, and you will certainly meet a grisly death. Well, the CEO of Detroit-based Meridian Health Plan is David Cotton, a huge Game of Thrones fan and a wolf fan. So his sons decided this was the perfect Father's Day gift. They donated the 20 grand. That means there will be a Cotton in an upcoming Game of Thrones novel and presumably the HBO series. No word on the type of character Cotton will choose, but it seems he will have a memorable exit, Valor Morghulis. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It looks like a new lease on life for the Yankee Air Museum. The Aviation Museum has signed an agreement to buy a piece of the Willow Run bomber plant in Ypsilanti. That's where the original Rosie the Riveter helped turn out B-24 Liberator bombers in World War II. Michael Montgomery is with the Yankee Air Museum. It really has been a touch-and-go fight to save at least that 144,000-square-foot piece of the old factory. It must feel good to know you've accomplished your mission.
It is. Well, we're not entirely there yet, but we've crossed an important hurdle. Signing the purchase agreement is an important step in the process. We're now in an inspection period. If listeners recall, when they bought their home, there was a period after they signed the purchase agreement during which the house was inspected to find issues that might present costs or difficulties, and we're in exactly that period now with the bomber plant. But since the plant is bigger and reusing an industrial building is much more complex, it's like being in the normal inspection period, only more so.
Mm. But you did have to do some major, major fundraising in order to be able to say that you've reached this point. How much did you have to raise?
We did. We set out with an initial goal of $8 million of cash and non-cash resources that would offset costs in the project. We still have not gotten all the way to $8 million, but we got to a point that we felt comfortable going forward with a purchase agreement. But we put together about $7.5 million so far in cash and non-cash resources against that goal, and have gone forward to purchase agreement while continuing to raise money, not only against that original goal, but also then against the cost of building out the interior and the exhibits of the planned museum.
In fact, Michael Montgomery, that's what I'm wondering. There have been so many hurdles thrown in the way of this mighty little museum, that, you know, like the little train that could. The Yankee Air Museum had that fire in 2004 that took 6 years to reopen, and then comes word that the Racer Trust was going to tear down the plant. And so you have really been in survival and fundraising mode for so many years. Are you letting yourself think that you can now start to focus on making the museum what you hope it can be?
Absolutely, but of course, that's going to require more fundraising, because the fundraising we've worked on so far, a little bit of it goes to acquire our piece of the bomber plant, and the rest goes toward the cost of turning that into a fully independent, fully functional building. So at the end of this phase of our fundraising, what we'll have is the money to basically have a big, empty, but powered up and ready to go building inside of which to then build out a museum.
And then do you have a sense that donors are willing to dig a little deeper to help make the museum actually happen? And be...
Very much so. The coming up with the money for bricks, what donors call bricks and mortar, is actually the hard part. It's much easier to find donors at the high end willing to invest in exhibits, in interior facilities like auditoriums and classrooms and programs, than it is to find the donors who will pony up for the basic costs of a floor under the building and a roof over the building and four walls.
When do you expect the inspection process to be done?
If we don't encounter insurmountable difficulties, we'll close on the building later this summer. And that's when people like me, who have been into this up to their eyeballs, will go, okay, we've really now, that's a bigger hurdle than this one. When we close, that'll be when we shout from the rooftops and do events to celebrate and to really thank our supporters.
Michael Montgomery is with the Yankee Air Museum. The Willow Run plant was built by Ford. Its mile-long assembly line turned out one B-24 bomber every hour in World War II, putting nearly 9,000 Liberators into the skies over Europe and the Pacific. This summer brings the 20th season for the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. Since its founding, the nonprofit Professional Theater Group has brought the Bard to thousands of theater lovers in Southeast and Mid-Michigan. The new season runs July 17th to August 17th. Janice Blixt is Artistic Director of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I love a quote that I read of yours in an interview. You were saying, "Too much of the Shakespeare that's being produced is pudgy, balding, and rather dour. I'm working to make the Michigan Shakespeare Festival dark and handsome with a twinkly eye and a knowing look." How will that dark and handsome be displayed this season?
Well, this summer, actually, the dark and handsome is all coming out in our production of Hamlet. For the 20th season, we decided go big or go home. So we're going big.
You are.
And we are putting up Hamlet. And the gentleman who's playing Hamlet is actor Sean Fouch, who has a long resume of music. He's a musician, he's an actor, he's worked with incredible companies, and he's coming in, and instead of the melancholy Dane, the very, very boring man who talks an awful lot and does very little.
And broods a lot.
Very broody. our Hamlet is a man who has been raised to be the king. He has expectations, he has ambition, he has all of the breeding and background to set him up for this job, and at the very beginning of the show, it has been stolen from him. And he is basically under house arrest for the entirety of the show, and it is him planning, plotting, running around the castle, trying desperately to find a way out of his current almost impotent state, because he is constantly being watched. He's constantly being squashed down because he is, of course, as the son to the previous king, the only one who could make Claudius's life difficult.
Yes.
So we are very much going for the conflict between these two men, between the power and the ambition of holding the throne of Denmark. We are looking at this play in terms of what actually happens in it. It's not about pretty talking. There's pretty talking, let's admit that, mm-hmm. but it's not about that.
Well, that's how you get butts in seats, isn't it? Because
absolutely.
The pretty talking is probably what keeps people feeling intimidated or that it won't speak to them.
And that they won't understand mm-hmm. it or that they'll feel like it's grand opera and something that won't connect with them. We work very hard to try and remind people that there's a reason that we're still doing Shakespeare 400 years later, and that's because it's hot. It's about passion, it's about life, it's about ambition, it's about goals, it's about striving, it's about love and loss and rejection. It's about all of the things that we watch our soap operas for and that we watch scripted drama for, and it's done really well.
What else are you offering this season?
Also this summer, we have Cymbeline, a rarely done Shakespeare.
I'll have to admit, I don't think I studied it in school. I know I've never seen it. Give us a
Nobody
sense of the
does.
Story.
Cymbeline takes place in the first century of Britain. And we have King Cymbeline, who has been sort of sidelined. He hasn't been appearing in public. He hasn't been running things. His queen, strangely enough, has been sort of taking the reins of power. And when the play starts, they are enraged over her marriage, the daughter's marriage, King Cymbeline's daughter Imogen, her marriage to her childhood sweetheart, as opposed to someone that the queen wanted her to marry.
Ooh.
And so it plays like a fairy tale. It's got, you know, your wicked stepmother, and it's got your king who has been kind of in the thrall of the wicked stepmother. We have our young heroine. We have, you know, the marriage that she wants to bring together. We have clowns and also the Roman army.
Well, you've got everything.
Exactly.
What is not to love? And then you bring us some Oscar Wilde.
Yes, we're doing The Importance of Being Earnest. Hamlet has some funny things in it, and it's a wonderful, wonderful show. Cymbeline is considered a comedy in that it does end well, and there are some funny things in it, but it's a romance. It's deeper, darker, more romantic, okay. And capital R. So we really wanted something fun, bright and bubbly and summery. And it's The Importance of Being Earnest. It's young British gentlemen in 1895 being very, very bad in order to pick up the women in their lives. And all of the witty language and the fun and the silliness. And so that's our bright, bubbly comedy.
Yet it's not the, if you're off put by the British farce with the slamming doors and the funny exits,
yes.
That's what this is not.
You are correct. It is not the five-door farce model. It is the more of the drawing room, I'm going to make fun of you to your face comedy. Is really what it is.
So if you want to get some good lessons from the master on how to skewer somebody verbally.
Absolutely. It's the show to see.
I have to imagine that your challenge, Janice, is not so much in preaching to the choir, to those who love theater and love Shakespeare, but you want to pull in new people to the party, but at the same time, keep it fresh for the veteran theater goers. How do you try to balance all of that?
What we actually do mostly is we try to go back to the actual plays and put them up the best way we can. We're trying not to put some kind of idea over the top of the show. Oh, we're going to do King Lear on Mars. Oh, you know, Hamlet is going to be set in Bosnia. We're trying to really look at the texts and find those things in them that make, that connect with people, that connect with audiences and actors, and then bring those out. So that when you're seeing a show that you may have seen five times before, you're going to hear things you never heard before. You're going to be touched and connected and remember why you love it. And if you've never seen it before, you're going to understand why other people do.
Janice Blix is Artistic Director of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. There was a big decision made for next year's festival. You're going to be expanding from your home base at the Potter Center in Jackson.
We are going to be expanding to Canton, to the Village Theater at Cherry Hill in Canton. We love Jackson. We love our home there. But we take very seriously the fact that we are the official Shakespeare Festival of the state of Michigan by decree of the governor and the legislature. And we know that we're really, really good. So we have made the decision to put half of our season in our usual home theater in Jackson. And we're going to add to that and do 3 weeks in Canton, which puts us in Wayne County, which puts us in the center of the more populous area of Michigan. And we're really excited about it. Cherry Hill has been absolutely lovely about it. Canton has been so gracious. So we're really excited about about our future, the future of classical theater in Michigan. When people say, why are you doing this? We're doing this because people love it, and we're proud of what we're doing.
And the location, well, I might remind anyone in Oakland and Macomb counties, you drive down to I-275 to go to buy a bedspread at IKEA.
Yes.
It's not hard to get to Canton from anywhere
from
in the Tri-County area.
Right.
So we can do that. Very, very fun. The Michigan Shakespeare Festival runs July 17th to August 17th, and you can find the full schedule and all the details on their website, MichiganShakespeareFestival.com. Artistic Director Janice Blixt. Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you very much.
To say it was a story that captured the hearts of the world is no exaggeration. A 14-year-old Michigan boy was searching for a way to call attention to cerebral palsy and its challenges because he'd seen his little brother living with CP for all of his 7 years.
Breaking news. Now I'm going to take a helicopter and talk to Hunter Gandy, the famous person.
That is Braden Gandy. His brother Hunter recently carried him 40 miles on his back. They called it the cerebral palsy swagger. Hunter walked from their hometown of Temperance to the University of Michigan Wrestling Center, arriving in Ann Arbor to cheers and celebration. You might think, wow, that's a tough job for Hunter, but it wasn't easy for Braden either, as Hunter explains.
Really, I think our biggest issue was the chafing that occurred on Braden's inner thighs from rubbing up against my sides for 30 miles at that point.
Wow.
And really, we were struggling. We weren't sure if we were going to be able to make it. We weren't going to quit completely. What we were planning on doing is I was going to push him in his stroller chair. Fortunately, though, we didn't have to result to that. We called a few friends, and I had a friend pray for me over the phone. And then his therapist called and had some ideas on how to change the sling that he was in. And then another friend of ours, who's a physical therapist, showed up and input her ideas. And after that, we were up and walking again. And I don't think after that, Braden complained one time.
The journey caught the attention of media outlets all over the world. But Mother Danielle Gandy says the hidden story in all of this is not what Braden and Hunter did, but the people who helped out along the way.
All the strangers that opened up their houses and their hearts and their homes and did things for us and for the kids on the walk and along the way. I mean, if Hunter would have walked and nobody would have paid attention, it wouldn't have made a difference. It's everybody else that paid attention and wanted to hear more and wanted to learn more that actually made it a story.
Danielle Gandy says the 40-mile walk is an example of how anyone can make a difference, no matter your age, no matter your ability.
All he did was have an idea, say he was going to do this walk to raise attention. I mean, it cost nothing. It took nothing. I mean, it was, and all he did was go out and walk, and people listened to what he had to say, and he said he wanted better mobility equipment for his brother, and he's getting it. I mean, it honestly was that simple. So anyone can fix anything that they need to or that they want to or that they're passionate about. People just have to have the courage to try.
But Hunter and Braden's fight did not stop after the cerebral palsy swagger was completed. Hunter's now fighting to completely reconstruct Braden's school playground.
He's there watching his friends run around every day. Every day until he gets through fifth grade. So we want him to be able to run around and play with his friends. We don't want him to be restricted by his equipment.
And Hunter says he is committed to fight for cerebral palsy for many years to come.
I want to go into biomedical engineering at the University of Michigan and hopefully create different walking mobility aids to help people with CP or other disabilities.
One very easy way to keep up with Hunter Gandy's campaign is to like their Facebook page, the Cerebral Palsy Swagger, and you can follow their blog at cpswag.blog.com, cpswag.blog.com. One of Detroit's biggest problems is blight, thousands upon thousands of abandoned homes, buildings, and vacant lots. All week long, Michigan Radio, along with the Detroit Journalism Cooperative, is digging into how the city is functioning in bankruptcy and under Mayor Mike Duggan. So let's talk blight. Michigan Radio's Lester Graham joins us. Hey, Lester.
Hi.
And we welcome Glenda Price, the president of the Detroit Public Schools Foundation and a Blight Removal Task Force member. So good to have you back on Stateside, Glenda.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You know, Lester, this problem when we talk about blight. This really, to me, seems like the cancer that sucks so much vitality out of the city. You don't even realize it because it's so prevalent.
You know, something I want to do, first of all, is define blight, because I was talking to a real estate agent the other day who didn't know what I meant by blight. So blight, I mean buildings that are crumbling, houses that have been burned out, vacant lots that have been filled with trash. There's a lot of blight in Detroit, and the task force that Dr. Price belongs to, as a co-chair of, recently issued this huge report, and her fellow co-chair, Dan Gilbert, was kind of giving us some big numbers.
So when you add it all together, 30% of all the structures in the city of Detroit, this has nothing to do with vacant land, are blighted, or 78,500 of them.
That's stunning.
So we've got tens of thousands of these buildings that are beyond saving. There are a few thousand, couple of thousand that the city owns right now that are worth saving, and the mayor is working hard to try to sell them. Land Bank is working hard to try to sell them at auction, and having some success, apparently.
But the money to think about what it would take to clear these away, Glenda, that just it's mind-boggling.
Well, indeed it is mind-boggling, because we have estimated that it would be approximately $850 million in order to remove all of the structural blight, and that does not include the vacant land that needs to be cleaned up or the very large industrial sites that also need to be remediated. So that's the residential and the small business blight in the city of Detroit. So you can see that the numbers are staggering.
Now, the good news, of course, is that the city has some money through fire escrow, through money set aside as the city's bankruptcy plan, if it all goes through as intended, private donations, some federal money. So the city, the land bank, the task force, they've got $456 million of that $850 million they needed. But the additional things that Dr. Price was just talking about, the big buildings, the big plants that need to come down, that's another approaching $1 billion.
And there's government structures, too, that we haven't even talked about.
Right. There are school buildings as well as a number of buildings that are, in fact, owned by the city themselves. Over the years, the city has acquired a large number of properties through foreclosure, through people simply walking away, et cetera. And the city has not had the finances to maintain these structures. And so even in some city-owned properties, there has been a continuing degradation of the community. But fortunately, now everyone seems to be paying attention, and we're going to be tackling this process or problem one community at a time.
So there's a plan now.
There is now a plan, and there is a strategy of tackling an entire neighborhood, not just a particular structure. And by doing so, we're actually looking at a reduction in the cost of the blight removal, because if you can get all of these structures within a particular neighborhood addressed at a, you know, I was going to say at a single flight, but very good.
One fell swoop with the crew all there.
One fell swoop with the crew all there. They can get all of the water turned off at the same time, all of the electrical disconnects that need to occur all at the same time, all of the environmental remediation that may need to occur, and that will reduce the cost of the demolition.
You know, we've had an example of that. Bill Pulte in Brightmoor neighborhood had been working on this for a couple of years. There's something like 98 acres of nothing but grassland and trees in that neighborhood right now, as they destroyed, demolished a lot of these vacant and crumbling houses. And it looks beautiful, but the real question is, now what? And Dr. Price and I, during a short interview at the Detroit Economic Council, talked about a little bit about what's next. And Dr. Price, so the neighborhood, what kind of input are they going to have when you get everything cleared away? What happens next?
Well, and indeed, it will be up to the various neighborhoods to provide input to what next. In some neighborhoods, what next will be to build new houses. In other neighborhoods, it will be gardens and parks. And in other neighborhoods, it might be light industry. But all whatever the decision will be made with neighbors in mind through the new district managers, there will be community forums and there will be conversations where individuals can provide input. There will be private ownership of a lot of those parcels again. The mayor is interested in as much of the vacant land that will be created by the demolition to return to private ownership, not to stay in the hands of the land bank or the city. After all, it is not the role of the city government itself to do that kind of development, and so the private sector will need to do so. Plus, it gets this land back onto the tax rolls.
Dr. Price, I'm wondering, just as someone so involved with Detroit and having been a part of Detroit's scene for so many years, what is most encouraging to you about these first 6 months since Mayor Duggan has stepped into the office at City Hall?
Most encouraging to me is the fact that there is a lot of conversation about the future as opposed to the kind of conversations that have occurred where we look backwards and bemoan the loss. We are now looking forward and talking about the options and opportunities. And so I think that that is a turning point that has occurred within the city, and people are excited about going forward.
You know, we've seen an increase in the number of demolition of these residential houses. We used to do something like 150 demolitions a month. The mayor says that's now up to about 500 a month, and by this fall it should be 800 a month. That's a lot of old abandoned buildings being torn down, but I'd be remiss if I didn't say there are a lot of obstacles. One of them is that $1 billion we were talking about that we still have to come up with, plus the rest of the $850 million. Fewer than half of Detroit's residents are paying their property taxes. That could mean a lot more tax foreclosures in the future and more houses to sell or demolish in the future. And the question is, do we get more torn down than end up back on the tax roll?
Well, I think that you know, that issue has been raised, but I don't believe that it is really a problem that we are going to face in a significant way. I think that because we are improving collection systems, there is now a recognition that a foreclosure may not be the best way to work with a family. We may need to refinance or put them on a different kind of a payment schedule so that you keep people in their homes. It's been the vacant structures that have deteriorated and have caused the blight, rarely the structures that people are living in and maintaining. So we've got to figure a way to not have as many foreclosures, not have as many vacant properties that get scrapped and burnt down, et cetera. And so I guess I am feeling and believing that we're not going to make those same mistakes again.
You know, I think one of the good things about this is that Dr. Price and her group have put together this 330-page report. If you've not taken a look at it, it's worth at least skimming through just to see how much, how involved this was. And you know, it's not just tearing down buildings and finding the money. There's a lot of other things that need to be done to make this process more streamlined and to make sure that we deal with some of the things that Dr. Price was just talking about. But for the first time, Detroit has a fully thought-out plan that could eliminate existing blight within 5, maybe 6 years. And that's something that Detroit's not had before.
Lester Graham of Michigan Watch and Glenda Price, president of the Detroit Public Schools Foundation and a Blight Removal Task Force member. So good to have you both with us on Stateside. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Cynthia.
Thank you.
These are challenging times for the Education Achievement Authority. That's the state-run district for failing schools. That system was announced in 2011 and currently operates 15 schools in Detroit.
EAA Chancellor John Covington has stepped down with a year left on his contract. And that has led many to ask, what does this all mean for the future of the EAA and for the students in those 15 schools? Bridge Magazine writer Chastity Pratt-Dossie has covered the EAA extensively. Chastity, was John Covington's resignation any kind of a surprise?
There had been talk for months that John Covington was going to resign, that there were some, I don't know, misgivings about his leadership and whether or not the EAA was going in the right direction. So, no, it wasn't a surprise to people on the inside and people in the district, and maybe even some parents may have been hearing this for a while.
And we had heard that there were smoke signals that really did kind of point to trouble, particularly in terms of whether the state was going to allow it to expand to other districts. And so what kind of trouble storm clouds have been brewing for the EAA?
The EAA has had issues from the gate, from the start when it was announced in 2011. Initially, the first year, I think that's where everything kind of started. They put it together very hastily. And it was supposed to be funded its very first year with donations, which you do not see a school district anywhere in the United States that's funded by donations. So its first year, the donations didn't really come in as expected. They get the kids, their second year of operations, they don't get the Title I money they think they're going to get. They have to borrow money using the Detroit Public Schools as a conduit. Then they lose students their second year of operations. Add to that, their MEEP scores were not what they weren't as expected. They were low.
Or as promised.
Or as promised, you know. They have this online individualized education plan, and it's not, its first year, it didn't show what people thought it would, what people hoped it would. So, and then you had state legislators who were saying, look, we put in freedom of information requests, we don't get it. And they're complaining that there's no transparency and John Covington has this lucrative contract and, you know, a pile on. The whole 2 years it's been operating, there's been a pile on of issues, problems, and criticisms.
With his resignation, what has the reaction been?
Again, not a lot of surprise. And people who are in the district are saying, what now? This sort of smells like, feels like DPS all over again with, you know, a revolving door very quickly of leadership. What's going to happen?
Well, tell us about his interim replacement.
His interim replacement is Veronica Conforme. She came to the EAA several months ago as their chief operating officer. The district will say she was a consultant. Maybe she had a consulting contract, but she was, for all intents and purposes, serving the role of a chief operating officer.
And she came from?
She came from New York City. She was a chief operating officer there. You know, it's the biggest school district in the country.
1,700 schools.
It's huge, a million kids. And so she is from the operational side of things, which I find interesting because this is an academic reform school district, but she's at the helm now, and I'm not sure where they're going to go for a long-term person. Are they going to keep Veronica Conforme more a business side type of leader? Are they going to bring in someone with more educational academic expertise? Who knows? I've not heard yet, but you know, we'll be digging around to find out.
Well, you have to wonder then, what does this mean first for the kids in the classrooms of those 9 elementary and 6 high schools? What do you think this change means, if anything?
Well, they have to do, if nothing else, a real marketing and PR blitz. They have to tell people, look, we know we've had issues and we're going to correct them. And I think just her first day being introduced to the public as the interim, that was her tone. They're, you know, it's a new day in the new district. We're going to correct some of the problems that we have been experiencing. And she really has to get out front of some of these problems and not so much throw Covington under the bus, but say, we are going to do better.
You had a recent report in Bridge, Chastity, that really proved that there are so many wrinkles that need to be ironed out with the administration, which makes me wonder aloud whether an operations person is needed to fix the operations. Tell us about what some of the graduating seniors have encountered.
A few weeks ago, maybe, I don't know, a couple weeks ago, I started getting calls from people inside the EAA saying things are really bad for our seniors. The operational issues, they're saying, okay, look, we have this computer program. It's new this year. It's, you know, student information system that collects records and grades. And we've had issues with it. Really bad issues, to the point where you had counselors handwriting report cards. Report cards for the third quarter came to the graduates a week before graduation. So what?
For the third quarter.
For the third quarter. They're getting, at Pershing and Henry Ford, they were getting their third quarter report cards, opening it up, thinking it was the fourth quarter report cards, but it was the third quarter report cards. And even more bothersome, Cindy, is the fact that you have kids who are applying to college who, you know, need to graduate now and get their records to their colleges for their acceptance process, for their financial aid process, and they're not sure when their records are going to be ready. At the very least, tell the kids when they're going to get their records so that they can, you know, have some ease about, you know, getting their financial aid and their your college registration completed.
When you call EAA officials, and I know you must have, about the, you know, stories you're hearing from these kids, is all they can do is point to the bad computer program?
Well, I sat down with them a couple of days before my story ran, and basically, yeah, you know, we're fixing it. We know we've had some issues. You know, don't worry. By graduation day, and this week is the last week for graduations, we'll have it fixed, and you know, we'll give them a couple of days to call and see and find out, and I'll follow up with some of the kids and see if they've gotten any assurances that their information will be in on time.
Overall, what are your hopes for this change at the top of the EAA?
It's an academic reform school district. They have to turn around the academics for these kids. You know, parents and kids and students and teachers on the ground level, they say, results. We want results. Don't give us excuses about, or explanations, whatever you want to call it, about operations and computers. Do something. Make it happen. Otherwise, what was the point?
Chastity Pratt Dossey is the Bridge Education writer, and she has been following education issues for so many years at the Detroit Free Press and now at Bridge. So keeping an eye on the EAA and the change at the top. Thanks for talking with us, Chastity.
Anytime.
Today's Stateside was produced and directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Chris Hattelsey, Taylor Mattia, Omar Saraday, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Brianna Tinsley. Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Ford Foundation. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.